Now, you will have, the thought will have occurred to you, I think, of how you manage to choose your ideas. And that's an important issue that James and others who take his kind of theory never quite deals with. Because you're not going to be able to pick your ideas without starting from other ideas. If will is what he says it is, then picking your ideas will be an act of will and can only be done in terms of the ideas that are already there. Now, there's nothing, inconsistent with that. It's just that you have to realize that what you do is going to depend ultimately on the ideas that you have. And if you are a hard Calvinist, you will say, "See, I told you. There is no ultimate freedom, perhaps no freedom at all, because you always have to start with what you've got. And if all you've got are ideas and no way of getting around that, then there's no way out. And if a person is victimized at the start by the ideas they have, they're wrong ideas, and they don't lead to God, and so forth, there's no freedom in choosing God for those people. If the God idea is there, okay, you're stuck with that. And if your idea is that you're God, you're stuck with that. And the real thing to take away from this is James's theory, I think, is very good in understanding how the will works. It works in terms of its ideas. But the question of where the ideas come from that provide you a basis for choosing to do what you do has to be dealt with in some way, separately from just a general account of how the will works. And this brings up the thought that the will might be something in its own right. And James actually, when he comes to the end, I didn't take time to read that, but he says the only thing that is uniquely you are your consents, what you consent to and what you don't. That's your contribution to reality. That is why you and your will is absolutely unique, and God will not override it because he has chosen to allow you a creative role in the world. That doesn't get rid of the problem, because now we have the problem with the nature of the will. Is it bent, twisted, distorted when we start? Or is it straight? And if it is the one or the other, who's responsible for that? Now, I just want you to understand that there is a problem, not an unsolvable problem, with the view of the will that James presents. And it is the problem, where do you get the ideas to start with? Now, one way of saying it is that, well, if you're a dyed-in-the-wool empiricist, which what James sometimes talks like he is, you say, well, you have sensations and things come to you from outside. If you're a Cartesian, you'll say, no, it all starts on the inside. And there's no necessary problem with that, though there are problems with each one, but there are ways of dealing with the problem. Now, what I am concerned, especially that you understand, is that you have a will and that it is capable of choices which instigate courses of action, plans of action, and you can do something about it. however you understand it, you can change your ideas. And that will provide a basis for doing different things. Now, I am inclined to take a rather radical view of the metaphysics of the will, which leaves it free and yet responsible. But my purpose is to try to impress upon you the importance of treating the will as a reality in your life, which opens up possibilities for change. And the difficulty with a strongly Calvinist view, which isn't well thought out, and often it isn't, is that it tells you you can do nothing about your condition. And you might as well say that whether you have lunch is beyond you, because you all you can do is sit there in the chair and see whether or not you're going to eat. It doesn't matter what your theories about that kind of determinism is, you still have to act. And at the practical level, it will make no difference what your theory is unless you become psychotic and decide that you should just do nothing and see what happens. Right. So in the Renovation of the Heart, page 33, you don't need to turn there, I just want to remind you of it, because there is a discussion here on 33 through 35 of the will. This is the section of the book where I'm talking about all of these aspects that I put on the circle. And it is extremely important to understand that we have the capacity to originate things and events that would not otherwise be or occur. This is right in the middle of page 33. By originate here, we mean to include two things, two of the things most prized in human life, freedom and creativity. These are really two aspects of the same thing when properly understood, which is the power to do what is good or evil. This power belongs to individuals alone. Organizations do not have it. And this gets us to another issue that was raised from the back of the room about social change. There is no such thing as evil structures or wicked structures or sinful structures. There are harmful ones. Organizations do not have a will. That is why they cannot repent. They don't repent. They don't have feelings. Individuals have that. Now, in our culture today, you have many people who don't believe they have a will or don't know there is such a thing as a will. And I want to just refer you to the paragraph at the top of page 35 in Renovation of the Heart. If you would, please just make a note, because, excuse me, people today generally think their feelings are their will. And they don't understand that one of the reasons you have a will is so you'll have a place to stand and deal with your feelings. And it's especially important for children to be taught this, because they're going to be endlessly bombarded by teaching that tells them it's just their feelings. We even have songs. Feelings. Whoa, 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 feelings. Right? Sometime listen to that song. And your feelings are an absolute disaster when you take them as guides. You simply can't do it. And, of course, that's where you have things like anger and resentment and contempt and so on. Those are very active combinations of ideas and feelings. Your will is the only possibility you have of organizing your life around what is good rather than what you feel. And that has so many levels of significance for human life that you can hardly begin to list them. But the divorce phenomena as it exists in our culture is fundamentally a reaction to the view that feelings are what you organize your life around. And I'm not saying divorce is always wrong or that's a different issue. I'm just saying the way it works now, it is basically driven by a certain view of feeling and will. Will gives you a possibility of acting for good that does not change over the weeks and the months and so on, if you get the right thing as the object of your will. So it's very important for us to know that there is a will. It's important for us to understand that a major part of the process we're talking about here is an act, if you like fancy words, of meta-will. I will to do God's will. I will to do God's will. I surrender my will to God. Now that is something you would do as a part of becoming a disciple, and then you will have to revisit it periodically as you grow, because you will discover dimensions of your life that were not surrendered. Oh, I didn't know you meant that. Right? Yeah, I mean that too. So I believe that this is a crucial thing for us to spend time on. Now, once you understand this, then you realize that in a certain sense, you live at the mercy of your ideas. You live at the mercy of your ideas. Because however you take it, your ideas set the parameters of your action. And you even have to learn that there are differences, there are ideas and then there are ideas. There are ideas of things like that. But this is not a very big idea. And the ideas that really matter are patterns of interpretation. They're patterns of interpretation that develop historically, have a large social presence, and they govern the world, and they are the primary place where Satan works. Because he knows if he can get a hold of them, everything will go his way in human life. Of course, everything is not going to go his way eventually, but his primary preoccupation is with human beings. He had a round with God, and it didn't turn out well for him. So his main focus is on God's project with human beings, because they do have freedom and can be messed with if you can just goof up their ideas. I mean, here's an idea. Did God really say? That's an idea. So we need to come through and understand submission of the will to God is the safe place for the will to be, because then it will be fixed upon God and things will go right as a result of that. So you need a verse or two to hang that on. Isaiah 26, I think it's 3-4. You know it already. Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace whose mind is stayed on thee because he trusteth in thee. That goes with Psalm 16:8. I have set the Lord always before me. See, that's the key. Now, If you haven't surrendered to God, you won't want to spend a lot of time thinking about Him. Because for the unsurrendered will, God is bad news. Big time bad news. I've included in Renovation of the Heart a quotation from Thomas Watson, a wonderful old Puritan writer. The first fruit of love is musing of the mind upon God. He who is in love, his thoughts are ever upon the object. He who loves God is ravished and transported with the contemplation of God. When I am awake, I am still with thee, he quotes Psalm 139:18. The thoughts are as travelers in the mind. David's thoughts kept heaven road. I am still with thee. God is the treasure, and where the treasure is, there is the heart. By this we may test our love to God. What are our thoughts most upon? Can we say we are ravished with delight when we think of God? Have our thoughts got wings? Are they fled aloft? Do we contemplate Christ and glory? Oh, how far are they from being lovers of God who scarce ever think of God? See, that's one reason why heaven would be hell for some people, is because God is unavoidable there. If you don't really like Him, it's going to eat you alive. That's why He excuses you to hell in that circumstance. A sinner crowds God out of his thoughts. He never thinks of God unless with horror, as the prisoner thinks of the judge.
What page is that?
That is page 106. So the most important thought we have is of God. Here it is. On page 100. Ideas and images are accordingly the primary focus of Satan's effort to defeat God's purposes with and for humankind. This is on page 100. We are subject to his chosen ideas and images when we are. He can take a nap or a holiday. And thus, when he undertook to draw Eve away from God, he did not hit her with a stick. He hit her with an idea. It was with the idea that God could not be trusted and that she must act on her own to secure her well-being. And that is the basic idea back of all temptation. I do this because I must take care of myself. And back of every minister or leader who falls is disappointment. And it's always disappointment with God. Tozer has a wonderful quotation here that I give on 100. That our idea of God corresponds as nearly as possible to the true being of God is of immense importance to us. Compared with our actual thoughts about Him, our creedal statements are of little consequence. Our real idea of God may lie buried under the rubbish of conventional religious notions and may require an intelligent and vigorous search before it is finally unearthed and exposed for what it is. Only after an ordeal of painful self-probing are we likely to discover what we actually believe about God. And in fact, from a human point of view, Jesus got killed for doing that. A right conception of God is basic not only to systematic theology, but to practical Christian living as well. It is to worship what the foundation is. It is to worship what the foundation is to the temple. Where it is inadequate or out of plumb, the whole structure must sooner or later collapse. I believe there is scarcely an error of doctrine or a failure in applying Christian ethics that cannot be traced finally to imperfect, ignoble thoughts about God. Cross-reference that to page 107, and you see some other things there following the quotation from Thomas Watson and connecting all of this to worship. Worship is actually, in the moment, the most powerful discipline. It is able to hold in abeyance every evil tendency in every dimension of the self, but at that level, the human being cannot live with it. It would be more distracting than Twitter. Worship is at once the overall character of the renovated life, thought life, and the only safe place for the human being to be. And there's a wonderful old hymn that says, "In our astonished reverence, we confess thine uncreated loveliness." So now then, what would the renewal of the mind mean? Why would Paul put it in the way he does in Romans 12? Romans 12, 2, be transformed by the renewing of the mind. Well, I'm hoping now with all of the stuff I'm laying on you this morning that you'll begin to put some real substance in that. And you need to put that, of course, with Philippians 4. And you might look at that a moment and ask now how you would fill that in, given what we've just talked about, because Paul here, sitting in jail, says, he has this wonderful treatment of rejoice and peace and so on in verses 4 through 7. The peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your heart and your minds in Christ Jesus. And then he says, "Finally, brethren, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is good repute, any excellence, if anything worthy of praise, let your mind dwell on these things." Now, what would be at the top of the list of things that are true, honorable, right, pure? What would be at the top of the list? God. Who? God. What an idea! And then, of course, how God has manifested himself in so many ways and how he's manifested himself in Jesus. And then you'll be ready to go on down to all the good things in life and understand that every good and perfect gift comes down from the Father of light, in which there is not even a shadow of turning away from light. And Paul's way of putting that is, the things you have learned and received and heard and seen in me, practice those things, and the God of peace will be with you. Paul practiced what he preached. The people he's writing to knew that he did. And this is primarily the way that disciplines were taught in the New Testament times. It was by example. And you might well say, well, if they're so important, why isn't there a chapter in Romans on disciplines? And the answer is because they were in front of everyone all the time. First in Jesus, then in those who followed and spoke for him. It was embodied disciplines. And so when Paul says, "I buffet my body," see, that's just saying something everyone knew. They knew what he did. And so a way of life is communicated through a community. And unfortunately, that is one of the weaknesses of our practice today. And we tend to judge leaders not by how they embody the life of Christ and what they do to do that, but in terms of their technical capacities in making the ship float and go. I may have already mentioned a wonderful man in one of my seminars some years back said, "They don't pay us to live." And unfortunately, it's true. It's true. And so you will have people who know that something is very wrong, but they will say to one another, "Well, for the sake of the ministry, let's don't say anything." In cases where there's sexual abuse of members, they often are given a rationale for not saying anything. It's terribly destructive. But, you know, the right wording would be, "For the sake of the ministry, for God's sake, say something." That's what's for the sake of the ministry. The sake of the ministry is never to cover up. Never. And we really need to carry that with us. All right. Well, whew. Now, the next thing we need to do is to, we put this up last time, but we need to do something a little more systematic with it. We need to go through these, not because they're all of them and all of that, so you understand that. Yes. But these are among the most commonly used disciplines. And so we need to just sort of go down the list and say a little bit about what each one is and what it does. Okay. Now, the more detailed treatment of each of them is in here. And you might want to just make a reference, 160 and following. This is chapter 9. 160 and following, you have this list given on page 158 and then some lead up to it. But now we need to do what we can to go through each of these and say what it is and what it does. And for the fuller treatment, I refer you to these pages. So now, what is solitude? Solitude is purposefully abstaining from interaction with other human beings. Denying ourselves companionship and all that comes from our conscious interaction with others. We close ourselves away. We go to the ocean, to the desert, the wilderness, or to the anonymity of the urban crowd. This is not just rest or refreshment from nature, though it can contribute to that. Solitude is choosing to be alone and to dwell on our experience of isolation from other human beings. Now, the main thing that solitude does is to free us from the constant interactions with other people that lock us into the habits and practices that make up our lives. But not because being with people is bad, it's not bad, but if that's all you've got, it can isolate you from God and keep you running in terms of what other people are doing and saying to you, and it will change the whole character of your life. To step out of that and, among other things, allow yourself to know what is happening to you there. It has a certain primacy and priority, I think, among the disciplines. That's why I listed first. If you begin to seriously practice it, my own experience, I backed my way into it. I had no idea what I was doing, but the effects were good anyway. I mentioned in the book that it takes 20 times more amount of amphetamine to kill an individual mice than it takes to kill them in groups. A mouse given no amphetamine at all will be dead within 10 minutes of being placed in the midst of a group that are on the drug. In groups, they go off like popcorn or firecrackers. Western men and women talk a lot about being individuals, but they are painfully lacking in it. And our conformity to social patterns is hardly less remarkable than the mice and just as deadly. So this is not dismissing community. This is teaching us how to live in community. In solitude, you go alone. You don't take your work with you. If you take your work with you, you're not alone. And you find who you are before God. You discover things like you really do have a soul, that you are a substance. And you discover that you are not alone. Solitude is the antidote to loneliness. Many leaders are desperately alone. And they often then seek relationships which are destructive. Solitude cures you of hurry. And it would be a wonderful thing if all of you could go away from here and never hurry again. You can still act quickly, but not hurry. There's a letter that John Wesley wrote in his, I think he was 71, though I'm always in haste, I'm never in a hurry. Because I never undertake any more work than I can go through with perfect calmness of spirit. So, solitude helps you learn how to be active, even in haste, but not in a hurry. What's the difference? What's the difference in haste and hurry? That would be a project for a seminar paper, I think, in your classes. What's the difference between haste and hurry? Well, hurry has in it the element of harassment. Haste does not. If you are taking your daily run, you might run rapidly, at least for a while, without being in a hurry. If a mountain lion is after you, you will suddenly be in a hurry. So the way to think about hurry is, what's chasing you? And the way you solve that problem in life is to practice solitude. Because in solitude, you lay it all down. You get out of the harassed position and you learn that you still breathe, that you don't die. That's a part of what goes into finding out you have a soul and that the reality is there in solitude. Well, I think this is really extremely important for us to think about and get us in a position where we can begin to take steps and get us out of passivity. And that's one thing that solitude does, because it breaks the grip of helplessness that comes from being locked into what everyone is coming to us for, what maybe we are laying on ourselves. You just step out of it. Henry David Thoreau used to say, he was lived in this heavily Calvinistic atmosphere. He said, "Men will lie on their backs talking about the fall of man and make no effort to get up." It is in solitude that you begin to find the place where you can apply effort to change things. Back in the corner. I'm sorry, about what?
Being alone in a crowd.
Yes, yes. Well, that can be two sorts of things. One is you can be lonely in a crowd. And as I say, the cure for loneliness is solitude. It will cure you of loneliness. It isn't the same as being alone. And so sometimes people are alone in a crowd, and that they are lonely, that means they don't have meaningful connections to the people around them. Now, they are connected, you can't avoid that in the crowd, but the connections do not assure you of connection with other people that provides a context of life. Now, one of the good things about practicing solitude is you learn that you can take it with you everywhere you go. And that also allows you to be alone in the crowd, but in a different sense. Among which is that if the crowd goes crazy, you won't go crazy too. And you will be able to identify, someone spoke of groupthink, and you will be able to stand before the audience of one, no matter what's going on around you. And that is two aspects, one negative and one positive, of being alone in the crowd. But remember, solitude will cure you of loneliness, and it will cure you of busyness. Busyness. Busyness is not a sign of importance. It's often a sign of self-importance. And solitude will help you in the realization that the world went on without you. And that will be a great liberation, because you will more easily bear the burdens that you have and know that God is still in business when you're not. There's a saying of C.S. Lewis's that he derives from the literature with which he was familiar, that busy people are lazy people. Now, what could he mean by that? He means busy people are those who are too lazy to make decisions and get to their calendar before other people do and decide what's going to happen. If you don't know that saying, you might want to write it down and think about it. Busy people are lazy people. Now, C.S. Lewis. Busy people are lazy people. And you want to understand what he means and how that works now. Okay, it doesn't mean that it's wrong to work hard. It's talking about managing your time. And he's talking about what kind of oomph it takes to decide what you're going to do and not let other people decide it. You have to have, now that means you're going to, in order to do that, you're going to have a place to stand. Like, how about the kingdom of God? Yes.
Are there ideas that you would suggest to help foster the habit?
the habit of?
Solitude, or the discipline of solitude.
Well, there are, actually, right now I'm working on the ideas, and then there are issues about how you go about it.
Yes.
Right. And the main thing that you have, this is where you apply the Vim pattern to a particular thing. You have to have a vision of what it is, so we talked about that, and why it's important, and we've been talking about that. Now, how are you going to get it? Okay. And that is where the oomph comes in, and you cannot be lazy now. You have to make a hard decision, and you do that by taking your calendar out. And you might have a little ritual or something which you danced around it and took control of it. Say, no one fills in my calendar but me. I am the only, God doesn't do it. I do it. Right. So, whatever is helpful. But the main thing, dear, is you have to have time, and you do not find time. You make it. Okay. And then, of course, you want some arrangements. You want a comfortable place. Don't do any discipline in a way that makes you miserable. There will be effort, and there will be unpleasant things involved in it. For example, most of us, it'll take us a little while before we stop jerking after we go into solitude. And we'll be, what's happening? What's? And of course, nothing is happening. That's the point. Nothing. The idea of doing nothing is one of the hardest things for people in our society to take, because they have attached their significance to their doing. Mm. And being busy is one way of being important. If you're busy, people shouldn't interrupt you.
So
they still will, but, sorry?
So this would also be a discipline you could use to encourage humility.
Humility is dependence on God, and so solitude is a way of taking your hands off of things. And if you are able to depend on God, you can do that, and you will need to build a habit of doing that. So it's definitely interconnected with that, and it's like most of these things, you need a little bit to start, and then you get a good deal more as you go along. But the basic thing is take control of your calendar. And you may have to say to your intimate associates something about what you're doing, because they may think this is very strange. And you do have to respect and consider them, and especially if it's your husband or your wife, you don't just announce, well, I'm going into solitude. Like you don't show up at dinner time and say, I'm fasting. If you are fasting and she doesn't know, and she fixes dinner, you eat. You eat. The old desert fathers and mothers knew that if you were on a long fast and someone came to your door, you prepared food for them and you ate with them. That was more important than fasting. So you have to, in all the disciplines, and I wind up saying a lot of things about solitude that have to be said about all the disciplines, but you don't need to say it over and over. You have to be very considerate of other people. Because, for example, solitude and silence is often used as a rebuke to other people. So you have to work through that, and you don't want that to happen. And so one way that you do is you try to arrange for others. If you have others on the staff and you want to go spend Friday and Saturday at a retreat house alone, you try to have others do the same thing. You'll not be overwhelmed with demand, I think, but you want them to know that that's available to them or for your wife. or others that are intimate with you. So you make arrangements for other people, is what I'm saying. And find time and find place. That's basically it. And finding a place is sometimes a problem for people in the way that we live now. But you just have to make arrangements, plan for it, and you learn a lot about how to do that as you go. Well, just another quotation here from Thoreau, and we'll go to lunch. Henry David Thoreau saw how even our secular existence withers from the lack of a hidden life. Conversation degenerates into mere gossip, and those we meet can only talk of what they heard from someone else. The only difference between us and our neighbors is that he has seen the news and we have not. Thoreau put it well, as our inward quiet life fails, we go more constantly and desperately to the post office. But the poor fellow who walks away with the greatest number of letters, proud of his extensive correspondence, has not heard from himself this long while. Read not the times, he concludes, read the eternities. Now, if he knew about email and Twitter and all of that stuff, he would have even more to say about it. A great part of solitude is turning off all the things that can get at us wherever we are now, and finding that we still live. Okay, we'll interrupt this here, and we'll come back and continue with this discussion.